you so much. So I will call the panelists and Dr. Tim Jones to come up to the platform for questions and comments from the audience. Thank you so much again.
So let me begin by, again, thanking each of the three panelists for very stimulating presentations, which I think tie together in a very, very effective way. And I can only emphasize again that Hugo Melgar-Quiñones brought together this panel, myself and my colleagues in the School of Dietetics and Nutrition, Human Nutrition, conceived of what we wanted to do on this particular day, but Hugo's implemented it, our concepts, in a way that first of all, demonstrates how seamlessly you're going to fit into our faculty. That bodes very well. The three perspectives that we have here, that I think that probably go beyond what we envisioned when we put together this panel, I think which represent geographical differences, institutional differences, and difference certainly in people's background are very complementary. What they emphasize certainly is the importance of social dimensions and social science perspectives and methodologies for really addressing problems that nutritionists look at in often in different ways. Both I think we've understood through your presentations more in terms of the importance of social determinants, but also social dimensions as intervention points from which we can address fundamental nutrition issues. I think certainly with Hugo's influence, what we've seen very strongly in this panel is the importance of data, and particularly certainly appreciate in all of these institutions, the importance of collecting reoccurring data that came through very strongly, and which for researchers that seems sometimes sort of rather mundane. But without that, we don't gain the insight. And certainly, I think you see the in terms of what panel emphasized the importance of operationalizing science for the evidence base for policy. Then this is absolutely essential. And as Mark said and others said, some of the patterns are not surprising. But without that data, you can't see that where the real entry points, the insights don't come through without that foundation. And I think it's those points that I think where we probably can talk more about. Certainly, the economic is an important component of this. But I think what we've seen here today that through all this, the presentations that as both terminants and targets, it's economic is not the only factor here, that there are so many nuances and other dimensions of social perspective that lead us, I think, with plenty to discuss here. So let me then turn the invite the audience to ask, to bring their questions to the panel. Yes, Joanne.
Thanks. Just picking up on Professor John Stamen.
You want to identify yourself? I don't know if you spoke yesterday as well, but it's good.
I'm Joanne Gaskell. I'm a postdoc at the University of California, Berkeley, and I have just picking up this idea of the importance of data collection. I wonder if the food security measures in Canada and the U.S. and Mexico include a broader definition of nutrition security, or if it's just a calorie measure.
Are you addressing that, I guess, to...
Well, so the USDA and Canada and Mexico, yeah.
Okay, thank you for the question. Is this mic working? Okay, this actually opens up a nice opportunity to talk about the difference between food security and nutrition security. And I agree entirely that what we're looking for at the end of the day is nutrition security. Food security... you might think of as a necessary but not sufficient condition to get nutrition security. If you can't afford enough food and you have no way to get enough food, nutrition security is almost unachievable. But even if you have, in the United States, we have 85% food secure. But if you actually measured nutrition security as achieved good nutrition, we have like 10% or 20% or something good nutrition in the United States. So it's a necessary but not a sufficient condition. In terms of measurement, our measures are not calorie measures. The Canadian, the U.S., the Brazilian, the Mexican, at least the food security part of the measure, there is an experiential measure. So the questions run like this. In the last, ours is an annual measure, in the last 12 months, did you or other adults in the household cut the size of your meals or skip meals because you didn't have enough money for food? In the last 12 months, were you hungry but didn't eat because you didn't have enough money for food? Then there are less severe as well. You couldn't afford to eat balanced meals because there wasn't enough food. So this is an experiential measure of just the economic access to food. The other pieces that mediate between food security, once you have food security, and nutrition security are other dimensions, and so you need a different measure for those dimensions. A single measure can only measure one dimension, or at most two, or maybe if you can visualize it, three if you have a cubic space. But most measures work best if they're only measuring a single dimension. And then you combine information from those various dimensions to find out what you want to know about the how those various pieces interact.
Question over.
Okay. So thank you for the presenters for their presentations, actually. My question is addressed to all of the speakers. It was interesting to see that most of the work has been done in countries that are actually governed in the systems of federations. So I know that in Canada, the food security issue might be a shared jurisdiction between the federal government and the provincial government. And I can assume that in the US, it's the same type of management. Not aware much about Mexico, but interestingly, Mrs. Messier has been working in Latin America and also in Asia. So I just wanted to know from your experience when dealing with decision makers, and I want to know to what extent the type of governance within the country, shared jurisdiction as opposed to non-shared jurisdiction, is a facilitator or an additional challenge in terms of gaining interest and create the dynamic to move forward on this issue of food security.
I don't know who'd like to start.
You might
that.
Have the best cross-country view of that.
That's an excellent question. Thank you. And I'm not sure how I'm going to answer that. If I take the example of India, it is quite a challenge because you have state programs and you have national program like the ICDS. And so what happens is that, and also you have great disparities, which is the same thing that we see in Mexico. And so how do you actually target those programs? How do you get government engaged? How do you, be Canadian, I guess I am allowed to say that, how do you prevent the federal and the provincial or the state to actually say, no, this is my role, no, this is my role? That's quite a challenge. And so I think it's to look at, most likely my colleague from Mexico is knows best about this, but I think it's about creating the right discussion and the right environment in terms of political engagement. Also looking at efficiency and looking at commitment on how to do this in a concerted way. So.
Yeah, I'm hoping Ricardo will comment more. I'm very intrigued by what you showed at the beginning, this relationship between university researchers and government and whether they, in fact, play a positive role, which I assume they do. I'm hoping they do.
Thank you. I look at first to talk about the data sources. For the first time, in the National Health Survey, the 2012 survey, food security has been incorporated together with some other indicators. And this, although it is not in the framework of poverty measurement, will allow us, and we are now in working in, on these issues, to validate our measures of food security. I should mention that there had been four previous nutrition surveys, and it had never been able to incorporate food security measurement. I think that one of the reasons why now has been incorporated is because Coneval is applying food security, and we have data on food security, and we are becoming a reference. And I would like to link this with your colleagues' questions, because Coneval is a federal organization, but since we have to produce state-level indicators, then we have, and since our data are public, the media constitute a strong basis and a strong pressure on the government of the states. And what we had noticed is that the new governors approached Coneval in order to incorporate our data and our diagnosis into their state development plans. I think that is good news. They don't want to be evaluated, the ones that are going out, but the new ones are glad to accept and to incorporate the data. Then I think those are good news.
I'll just make a couple comments on that. In the United States, it's pretty centralized in terms of assistance, other than cash assistance, which is becoming a pretty small piece of the puzzle. So states have, in terms of direct assistance, are relatively small players, and it's mostly federal government. But the programs, although they're funded, the main like nutrition assistance programs funded at the federal level, but they're operated by state agencies. And it turns out there's a lot of difference in how states operate the programs, so that the participation rate of eligibles, for example, in the food stamp program varies a lot across states. I'm going to take a little diversion to talk about how the scientific knowledge from these kind of surveys actually, in my experience at least, comes into the policy process. You know, maybe in my naivete I would have thought that, you know, Congress is just sitting there waiting for the information from us so they'll know what to do. But of course that's not the way it works. The advocacy organizations take our reports, they draw it to the attention of the media, the media makes big noise about it, and then the politicians have to do something about it. So in the very first years that we published state statistics in the United States, very big surprise, the state with the highest rate of severe food insecurity was Oregon, which nobody would have guessed. There was probably some measurement error. It was probably second or third, but it looked like it was the worst. And this created a huge furor in the state. I knew that a lot was going on there. I happened to have a son and family living there. And so, yeah, I'd kind of go incognito whenever I went to Oregon. A few years later, I knew that quite a bit was going on there, and I did a little Google search on the governor's name and hunger. And he had been all over the, he ran partly on a platform of doing something about hunger in Oregon, organized a summit that brought together nonprofits as well as government agencies, was stomping around the state advocating for better use of the, more complete use of the federal programs. The rate of participation of eligibles in the SNAP, the food stamp program in Oregon, went from middle of the pack among states to the top within about a four-year period following that survey measurement. And their rate of very low food security came down into the kind of indistinguishable from the national average. So states do make a difference, and what state people do does make a difference, even in the United States, which is much more largely centralized.
Thank you. Next question here, and again, please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Nassim. I'm from the School of Dietetics from McDonald campus. And I have a question from Ms. Murray. I did my undergrad studies in Iran, and it looks more familiar to the population that you are studying and you are talking about. And during my studies, I have the chance to visit some rural areas. And in that visit, we were by chance together with some group of hygienists, dental hygienists, that were assessing the status of the dental status of the kids. And then when we were sharing our experience, they were mentioning that this is so difficult because these population are low in education and low in income. So even when we give them the toothbrush and the next day we ask the kids, how did you do with the toothbrush? They say that our father used that. So the same thing is with the food. And, you know, this happens always. I just wonder from that time that how it's going to be possible, all the efforts that you are doing to the end result would be more food in the access of kids and their mothers.
That's also a very an excellent question. We were talking about gender balance at the table, and it's the same thing in countries. And I did touch on the subject of women empowerment. The evidence showed that when a woman is more educated or has more economic power, that means her revenue increases, she will invest this money into the well-being of her children, notably in nutrition, education, and health services. So this is why there is this big focus on countries with high gender imbalance to try to capacitate the women in doing so. However, this is quite important, but the power within the household is quite very important. And working in Africa, a lot of times what you will see is that the power of the woman, how did you say that, improves with age? And so grandmothers have a very high power over the decisions, and they're living in these large families. And so it's very important to look at empowering a young mother in terms of economic, revenue, knowledge, decision, but looking into the social context where she has to make decision or where can she make decision, which is how do you also increase the knowledge of her husband so that not only does he understand why she's doing this, but also doesn't feel threatened by his wife saying something. But very importantly is working on the grandmothers. For breastfeeding, for example, not give water right away. A lot of these traditional concepts, not having a child every year, is very important in our important determinants of malnutrition. And so, and then in the broader context also of social and peer pressure is very important. So I think it's very important to focus on women, but also acknowledge that women are not the silver bullet for everything, but she is in a social context, and how can you influence those?
Please.
My name is Nurul Akant. I'm from International Center for Biosaline Agriculture. I have just one comment to Mary. She was presenting Southeast Asia context of the nutrient security concerns. It is, again, relates to the political intervention that I can feel that. About a couple of months, I have a chance to talk to one of the ministers an agriculture minister of South Asian countries. When I talked to her, that I asked her for the fishery as well as for this, livestock on poultry sector. Then she told me, well, look, we are more emphasized on cereal production. Of course, for example, in Bangladesh, if you look at now, they give a lot of subsidy in cereal sector. Their supplies in rice production, what happened to the fishery and livestock? They're not getting subsidy at all or minimum subsidy. So for the getting the nutrient security, government intervention, especially developing country like South Asian country, is very important. Thank you.
That's a comment. I don't know.
It's a comment, and I cannot agree more. This is what we're fighting for, I think a lot of us, is that it's not about calories or it's not about staple food, but it's about diet diversity. And it's very difficult to have governments, and often with the ag sector especially, they focus a lot on revenues, they focus a lot on production, but not necessarily on the quality. So they focus on quantity and not enough on quality, and I think that's the major challenge that we need to address with policymakers.
Next question.
My name is Michael Ham. I'm chairman of Cubic Farming Inc. And I experienced my undergraduate in 1952 when I was lying in hospital recovering from malnutrition. 3 years later, I conducted my graduate studies also in hospital for 8 weeks. Again, suffering. I've been around a little bit, and I noticed when I was in Cuba, the three most successful things about the society there is education, medicine, and sports. The three biggest failures is breakfast, lunch, and supper. So what do we do about this? Well, the thing that saved me from malnutrition was bread and beans, because beans was cheap and bread was cheap. So how do we go from here to where we want to be? In the society I grew up in, I was obviously come from a poor household, and I noticed all my neighbors, they had fathers that could work, and my mother was a war widow, but my mother didn't drink, but all my friends' fathers did, and I always seemed to have about the same as my friends. I guess one of the challenges is not giving more jobs or more money, but certainly supplying more food. The finest thing in my life was a school food program. And that's why I'm here to share that.
Thank you. There wasn't a specific question in that, but if there's any comment.
In Puerto Rico, they have an excellent school food program. It works very well, especially for single mothers and children otherwise wouldn't have food. I believe that the school food program is where we should all start, so that the children can grow up, first of all, healthy and know what normal food is. And then when they start working, then they would perhaps come into industries to try and propagate that system. And my question is, what's getting done about this in Southeast Asia or in Mexico, etc.? Is the school program high on the priority, or is it something that just happens through local or state politicians?
Or Hugo, do you have any perspective on that as well?
Actually, there is a number of programs in different regions in the developing world, certainly, and school programs are part of that effort. Just briefly, I wanted to comment that the number of interventions that are being put in place are very diverse, but the impact of those interventions are also very diverse. And one of the things that we briefly mentioned in the introduction of this panel, but is probably a topic for a one panel overall, is the interventions, right? Cash transfers, for example. For the World Food Day in Mexico, Dr. Abelardo Avila at the National Nutrition Institute mentioned very severe impacts of the cash transfer programs in the nutritional status of the Mexican beneficiaries of that program. So I'll leave it there because I know we're running out of time. But
And in fact, we have 5 minutes before we're going to take a break. That may be time for one question or maybe for more than one, but we'll start with one. I can't guarantee to the people that are standing that I'll be able to take your questions, but we'll go as far as we can.
Yeah, my name is Galina Stulina. Yeah, I am from Uzbekistan, from Central Asia. It's my question, maybe to all reporters. How is poverty line for Canada or for USA? And it's the one question. And another question, how what do you think about the food basket? It should be recommended from from it should be medicine recommendation, or it should be different for different different area for different country. Thank you.
First question, if you want some clarification.
Yeah. Was your first question about poverty level?
Yeah.
Like the percentage?
Yeah.
In the United States, the income poverty measure, which we're very much poorer than Mexico in terms of measurement of poverty. We only have an income poverty measure and then the food security measure. And they're pretty close. Poverty is around 14%, between 14-15%. It was lower before this last recession, more down around 11-12%. That's income poverty. Our food insecurity is about 15%, so about the same.
Yeah, but for poverty, what it means poverty? It's $1 per month.
I understand. So you're asking about the measurement.
Level?
Okay.
Yeah, level.
And the original measure of poverty in the United States was based on the cost of what people considered to be a kind of basically adequate food diet, and then multiplied by three. This was developed back in the 60s when households spent about a third of their income on food. So that was the concept of the measurement of poverty. It's around, for a family of four, two adults, two children, now it's around $22,000 a year.
Yeah, there was a second part of the question on food baskets. I don't know if anybody has a specific perspective.
What we do in Mexico is to have a food basket, an empirical food basket, or observed food basket. We are working now on developing what we could consider an adequate food basket promoted through public policies. And I would also like to use this the voice to share some of the things that we have done at the local level authorities. In Chiapas and Guerrero, who are the two poorest states in the country, the mayors just took over 3 weeks ago. And then we went with all these 120 presidentes municipales de Chiapas and 80 presidentes municipales de Guerrero, and we showed what was their data, their municipality poverty data, their food security data, and we told them that this was the challenge they had, and that they would be evaluated through these baselines. Then we'll see if it helps to improve public policies.
Okay, there's still one question. I'll allow you to ask your question. I'm not sure we'll be able to take time for a full answer, but.
This is to Mr. Aparicio. And you talk about this working group from the government that was created. I wonder if you can expand a little bit more on whether this group will allow participation of women farmers it was mentioned here about the importance of women empowerment, and so what is the relation of this group with the women farmers and other parts of civil society that are working on the issue of food security, and then whether this group intends to tackle the issue of imported food in Mexico, especially corn, that is putting at high risk a lot of people in Mexico. That's my understanding. Thank you.
If you can maybe answer that in a direct answer without going into too much detail.
Yeah, yes. It is an interinstitutional group in which the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Education is engaged. But there are no civil society participation. It's just governmental work in this group.
OK, Okay, thank you again to the panel and to you, the audience. I know there were other questions. I invite you to come up after and speak directly with each of the speakers. We're going to take a break, a 15-minute break now. 10-minute, okay, Carolyn said 10-minute. We've talked too long. I'd also remind you to complete the comment and survey forms that are on the tables. Thank you.